It's Anthony Chadwick from the Webinar Vet. Welcome to another episode of Vet Chat, the number one veterinary podcast. And I'm very, very pleased to introduce everyone to Mark Leddy, who is a veterinary surgeon, hailing and qualifying from the great city of Liverpool, just shortly after me, actually, which we realised. And a LinkedIn friend. I think we started to sort of communicate via LinkedIn because Mark is in the interesting situation of being a vet, but was actually helping to run a GP practice. So we got chatting, we realized we shared interests in where we went to university, but also around environmental issues. But Mark, welcome to the webinar and great to have you on.
Yeah, lovely to see you. And it was a very interesting conversation we had late one evening. I recall, I think you were trying to get a train to a BVA meeting, and I think I was trying to do my online shopping. And we accidentally started talking about storage batteries, and I think about an hour and a half went by.
Yes, it was all very interesting. And yeah, it's great to see today. My battery has not always been getting full up over April and obviously earlier than that because it was dark. It's been a funny old month. Liverpool probably gets less sun than Oxford, so I imagine your batteries and your solar panels are doing a bit better.
Yeah, we've done a little bit better. We do use a lot of power though, because we're fairly decarbonized, let's say, so we do use quite a lot of power, so we do have to charge overnight as well as from the roof. But it's not been the best, has it, with all this cloud?
Yeah, and the decarbonisation thing is interesting because we had our kitchen redesigned. That's another story. That could be a webinar and a podcast on its own, you know, the 1 to 10 day thing that turned out to be a month. And actually, mm-hmm. if you've got one important room in the house, it probably is the kitchen, isn't it? You know, you can mm-hmm. you can do a lot without a bathroom. You know, you may be fortunate enough to have another bathroom, a living room, etc. Even a bedroom, there's usually another bedroom you can go into, or you can sleep on a couch. But not having a kitchen for a month is a bit of a struggle.
Absolutely.
So we actually, as part of that, went and decided to get an oven and a cooker that was an induction hob. So we've mm-hmm. obviously, again, started to try and get out of gas and more into electricity. Obviously, we get our electricity from good energy, which is a 100% sustainable energy, and then having your own solar panels, which I've had for about, thermal about 16 years and PV for over 10. Adding a battery in last year, it all helps to politely and gently stick two fingers up to the greedy energy companies. Although I notice they're now starting to sell solar panels.
Yes, indeed. We were talking actually the other day about antibiotic reduction and about how in the very early days there was the first company, I can't remember which company it was, that actually started promoting the use of less electricity. We were saying about how, you know, there's an evolution there with antibiotics as well, wasn't there? The same thing about the idea that suddenly you had pharmaceutical companies recommending you weren't going to use an antibiotic or you're going to use less. And it is interesting how ethics has now played a much bigger role, I think, in the way people choose things and the way corporations have to run. It's a really good pressure, I think, to improve a lot of things.
Yeah, and we definitely do need to decarbonize. I think it's going to be a long time before we can probably completely get rid of oil, but opening new oil wells. I have a friend who's an oil man, retired now, but I think we do have a job. Maybe our role is to show an example of we could do this, but we've decided not to. So I do hope that is a decision that we maybe can think about going against at some point, because it does seem a crazy one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think from sort of our perspective, we've looked at a number of things. There's a lot more things we can do. And originally I was thinking, there's no way we can, because of our lifestyle or whatever, that we can really decarbonize. And then I think your mindset changes after a while and you think, well, why don't I just do the easiest things first? Or why don't I do the things that are possible? And suddenly when I had that attitude, then suddenly we were able to do a lot more. And that has helped a lot, you know, rather than saying, well, you know, it's evil to use any oil. I think you have to be quite realistic and just go through what you can change and what you can afford to do.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem. I saw a survey, 89% of vets and nurses from the BVA, you know, are interested in sustainability, but then part of the issue is they're not sure what the next step is, and so therefore they don't do anything. And of course, the journey of 1,000 miles starts with a first step, and obviously you take the easy things first. So there's always things you can do, but if you think, oh, it doesn't matter, or it doesn't make a difference, or I'm not going to make a difference, then it can sort of paralyze you into doing nothing, can't it?
Oh, absolutely. I think also as well, because of the way that veterinary practice is set up, and because any medical operation is set up, you have the issue that there are other factors which are very, very important, you know, sterility, single use, disease control, cross-contamination, yeah. All of these things, you know, they will impact. And I think they make it a particularly difficult industry in which to actually do anything. And I think that's where people do get quite demoralized. But I think it's nice now. I mean, we talk about, whether we get on the topic of corporatization, and I don't sit in either camp on that one particularly. But it is interesting to see how they have to take an interest in all of that now, you know, has to be part of their report to shareholders and so on. So I think it's an area where there will be more and more to be done. And I think they will start also to push, encourage, maybe a combination of both, a lot of the suppliers to actually start thinking about what they can do rather than just think, oh, it's impossible, let's not worry about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We've started the last 2 years doing the Veterinary Green Discussion Forum at a nature reserve. And it's been really heartening to see how certainly a segment of the profession has really embraced that and seen it as, yes, we need to move forward. A lot of companies are afraid of being accused of greenwashing, so they therefore say we won't say anything. Whereas I'm actually of the other opinion that with, you know, all the bad news that's about, I kind of then think we're a bit duty bound to tell good news stories, to actually cheer each other up. And I think there is a lot of good things going on. They may be a little bit fragmented, whereas hopefully by bringing people together at the Veterinary Green Discussion Forum, people realize that they're not on their own, that there are people who are interested in this, and that we can actually make a difference. And it's been really heartening. It was a not-for-profit conference, and off the back of the first 2 years, we've been able to raise some money for Lancashire Wildlife Trust, which has helped them to rewild 30 hectares of exhausted livery land that they, you know, perhaps wouldn't have been able to do without it. So it's nice to see something really practical happening, because we can all talk about the environment, and we can all talk about how terrible it is to have plastic in the oceans and the temperatures are going up. But actually, as people of hope, it's important that we just do something about it. And the small things we can do, you know, do matter, because if we all do a bit, it adds up to a lot.
Yeah, I agree with that one. I think the other part for me as well is that we mustn't underplay the ability of technology and the speed at which technology can help us. An example I was looking at was the idea of people like Axel and the idea that you know, everybody who's got a little bit of battery storage can give back at the right moment to be able to stop a gas-fired or a coal-fired power station being started. You know, when you start to look at that, there are opportunities that are out there, and I think there are technologies that will change things very rapidly. I mean, the other day I noticed, for example, I came home early from something. I plugged my car in. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And Octopus decided to charge my car for an hour because the grid was especially green and they wanted to use power up. You know, things like that, I think, are really clever. And they're really useful. And we will see, you know, more and more things like that. I think the challenge at the moment is the technology itself is still fragmented. And I think we're also seeing, you know, issues of understandability. I mean, I can't work out, for example, you know, when I should be using my battery power versus when I should be using solar power, and when do I actually put the washing machine on. There must be somebody who's a lot better at mathematical modelling than me that's going to be able to crack that one, and I'm going to be able to just push one button, a bit like a Nest thermostat. You know, I don't have one, but you just press one button and it works it all out. I think we're on the verge of quite a big change there, and I think that will also hopefully make people more willing to take the leap and also be able to understand more accurately before they start what it might cost them. Because that's the other thing, isn't it? You know, the upfront cost of some of these things is a lot, and it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. We could finance it in different routes. So, yeah, a lot going on in that space.
Yeah, government could, I think, certainly help in the subsidising that they are doing in other areas. Encouraging a green revolution. You know, every new house should have solar panels on if they're suitable and, you know, they're positioned in the right way to take that solar, then we should definitely do in that. I think technology, as well as being a great plus, you know, can also be a negative, because of course we're in a situation now where I think it was the Netherlands government refused Meta access to the country to build a data center because they said you're actually using too much energy and it's going to compromise the, you know, the national supply to ordinary people. And it's something I heard about at Sustainability Live in March in London. Within the next few years, 30% of Irish electricity is going to data centres, and I presume there's a similar number, you know, with places like the Netherlands. And a lot of that is with emails that nobody ever looks at, or things that are stored like photographs on, you know, iClouds and so on. So I'm looking very much at how we can, as a profession, I'm sure as a collective, we could save an enormous amount of energy by just using technology a bit less or deleting emails or not sending an email in the first place, which sounds a bit countercultural for a digital company to talk about. But I think we have a responsibility, you know, in that area as well.
Yeah, I think it's another area, isn't it? I was doing a course on artificial intelligence, and I'm sure you've had people on this podcast who are much better at understanding all that tech than I am. But one of the things I took home was actually building the large language models that are being built now take a tremendous amount of processing power over a tremendous amount, you know, an awful lot of energy. Yes. And there is a big argument there at the moment, unless things change, that is also going to be a consumer of a lot of power. And amongst all the other ethical dilemmas of AI, it's another one, isn't it, to decide, okay, are we comfortable that big tech companies that have a lot of money can put, you know, a huge amount of energy requirement to be able to do all these things? We all love the output of all these things, don't we? Like, we all like the things that reusable plastic will do for us, but we don't think about necessarily what the end result will be.
Yeah, and I think the artificial intelligence is a really good example of, there are obviously some very good things that come of it, but you have to consider those. And sometimes you get surprised, you know, we all wanted to go paperless, but by going paperless, have we then encouraged ourselves to put more and more stuff that we don't need to keep on, you know, data centers and on servers and so on. So it's an area that I think, as you get more and more into this environmental issue, you realize that nothing's black and white. There's a lot of gray. And actually, the more you get into it, the more you realize that the less you know.
Absolutely.
But, you know, we can look at things like electric cars and say, yeah, they do use a lot of carbon in their construction. Yes, the batteries are problematic. But if we went and really encouraged the green revolution of you know, really embracing solar, for example, then that has to save energy. That you know, that gives us more energy. I think one of the other issues is we seem to be going up about 1% a year in our energy usage, so that we have to decouple that and start using less energy, because otherwise the solar just becomes what helps to power the AI, but we still need to burn oil because we've got to do the other stuff as well. So it's complex. It's philosophical conversations, but interesting nevertheless.
Yeah, there are lots of challenges. And I think, you know, I think one of the best phrases I heard about it all, somebody said, well, what's best for now? What's the best option now? And I think it's probably the only way you can actually make a step forward, isn't it? Rather than saying, well, I won't move because I can't get it perfect. Yeah. What's the best option now? I mean, we have one electric car. We have two vehicles. One's electric. And, you know, some of our friends have said to us, well, they're not very environmentally friendly. Same old arguments come out. I'm like, well, it's the best we can do for now. And at least we know we're helping local pollution. We hope we're helping our carbon footprint. But we know that if I drive past a school, which I do every day, I know that at least that's something I am doing. Those children are breathing healthier air than they would do if I was going past in my diesel car. It's that. You know, so there are tangible benefits, even if everything isn't perfect.
Yeah, and 90% of the time a car spends at home, so maybe we can do more on the sharing economy. So there's lots of interesting areas, you know, to look at as well, aren't there?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Are you currently looking for a new role? Or maybe you're thinking about locuming but don't know where to start? Contact Simply Vets. We are a sister company to the Webinar Vet. We offer a tailored recruitment guidance to help you secure a dream permanent role. And we run Locums Payroll too, which is free for the locums to use. Visit simplyvets.com to find out how we can help.
So that obviously, we both share an interest in sustainability, obviously why we were got chatting on LinkedIn. But a veterinary surgeon qualifying in the early 90s, I was actually 1990, so we were there roughly at the same time, but I don't think we got to know each other when we were at university. What sort of happened post-graduation and what weird and wonderful path have you led to be running a GP practice?
Well, it has been an interesting one. So I qualified. I was one of those people, you know the sort, age 11, met cows on a farm, thought, I'll be a vet, that'll be fine. Never got talked out of it. Everyone told me it was impossible, it's too hard to get into, whatever. Managed to do all of that. And then I did the very classical thing. I actually went into very small mixed practices. So my very first job was me and my boss. And it sounds terrifying now, but 4 months after I was qualified and started working for him, he went on holiday for 2 weeks. And he said to me, oh, don't worry, I've booked a locum. But he only booked a locum for the second week. So I spent 1 week as a four-month qualified graduate, you know, running the practice. Anyway, long story short, I learned a lot in that time. But after about 6 years, myself and my then wife realised that life was pretty much a series of post-it notes on the kitchen cupboard. And we weren't really seeing each other. She was a junior doctor. I was doing the vet thing, you know, doing one in two rota, one in three rota, whatever. And so I was like, okay, we'll try something else. And I saw an advert for a veterinary advisor job with a local pharmaceutical company. And I thought, and I'd met a Hills rep who was a vet who drove a really nice car. And I thought, that seems like quite a good job. He drives a nice car, he turns up in the evening, he buys the food, he does a talk and goes. Anyway, so cutting long story short, accidentally fell into the vet pharmaceutical industry through that. And then after about 2 years of hassling the marketing department, because I would have to proofread their output and make sure it was okay from a technical point of view, I used to come in and go, yeah, technically it's correct, but as a vet, by God, that's boring. And actually, you know, I'd be interested in this bit or that bit. So they rather foolishly gave me a product portfolio, made me a product manager. And I worked as a product manager, then I worked as a marketing team leader, then I ended up as marketing director for UK and Ireland for the company. And I absolutely loved that. And then I probably worked there about 12, 13 years. And the only thing I realized was that I was a vet. I'd been qualified by that point, a good number of years into the teens, certainly. But I had no formal business qualification. So I initially looked at the idea of doing an MBA part-time or whatever. And I had a very supportive boss who then unfortunately left the company while I was still deciding whether I wanted to go down the MBA route. Had a new boss who thought MBAs were pretty pointless. Had a discussion with him and it didn't go anywhere. So about 6 months later, I put my car keys back on the desk and I left and spent a year at Warwick University doing an MBA full time. And that was absolutely fascinating because that opened my eyes to so many things. For example, the fact that actually many of the problems that we have within the veterinary industry are absolutely not unique to the veterinary industry. And until that moment, I thought, you know, certain things were very specific and they're not. And suddenly I'm talking to, somebody who's a electronics engineer specialist from India, who's also on the course, who's explaining how he solved a problem. I'm thinking, damn, why didn't we do that? Why didn't we have that idea? So that got me much more interested in the world of networking and about the fact there was a lot more out there. And I did a lot of stuff on the social sciences, a lot of stuff on behavior, and started to realize what a huge impact behavior would have. And I went from that point, I started off a veterinary. I got really interested in why do people buy things, or more particularly, why do people make decisions? You know, how do people make decisions? Because I think as a vet in a consulting room, we are actually spending an awful lot of time guiding people to make decisions. We're guiding our clients to make decisions and decide what to do. And how we put that is of critical importance, not only as to what is the final decision they make, but also about how do they feel about that decision. I'll give you a very topical example, if I may, and go off piste a little bit. The Competition Markets Authority, obviously, they're diving in, and there's been a lot of questions about how have we got to this stage. And the idea now about how gold standard treatment has become overplayed, and how we, you know, contextual based care, which I think is going to be talked about more and more and more over the next few years, how much more important that will be. Back onto my career, I'll talk about when I worked in 24 hour emergency and critical care, because that was really showed up at that point. Because what you start to realize is if an owner cannot afford the gold standard treatment, it's really important to make them comfortable about the decision they have made for their pet. And I think that there's going to be a big change there. So anyway, long story short, got really interested in behavior and everything else. And I led a number of teams in a number of different commercial situations. And I got more and more interested in leadership. So when I left, I took a job as clinic director of a big 24-hour veterinary clinic. And applied a lot of the operations management stuff and so on. But my heart really wasn't there. My heart was still within the commercial side of things a little bit more. So I then went in to work with a veterinary anesthetic company, and then finally also then helped set up a subsidiary up for the Doe Pharma Group in the UK as well. And I ran their subsidiary for a number of years. And after the startup of all that was done and everything was reorganized, I left. And that's how the idea came that I would help create a private human GP practice, which of course is slightly bizarre thing for a vet to do. But my wife's a GP, and we had this idea that we would do that. And actually, as much as it was only ever going to be a temporary position for me, just for 6 months or a year, just to see, set things up and then hopefully hand them over, actually, it's been really interesting to look at that contrast between what happens in human private medicine, particularly primary care, versus veterinary, and how some of the challenges are completely the same, but some of them are also, there's other things which are very, very different. And I think the most important one is that with the human side, particularly in primary care, you've always got the fallback of the NHS. So you're not obliged, for example, to treat a patient. You can just send them back into the NHS primary care. Whereas, of course, with vets, and I think increasingly now with the complications of practice ownership, it's really hard to be able to comply with the Royal College guide, keep your practice owners happy, and also do the right thing for the pet. And it's not really that surprising. We've got so many issues with mental health and stress and so forth, because you're trained to do one thing, and then you arrive in an environment which is very different to the environment that would allow you to do what you hope would be your primary purpose. So my journey has been very, very different, and it's just about to take another little turn. I think in the next couple of weeks, when I'm going to pop up somewhere else in the veterinary world. But in the meantime, I've got about a week.
You're back in the veterinary world.
I am. I will be. Hopefully, I'll be doing something very interesting. Leading another team, which I hope will all begin next week by the looks of it. And then maybe we'll come back and we'll talk about that project, because it does have some interesting angles above and beyond the commercial side.
I was going to say, it does feel a bit like an 80s American soap opera like Dallas, where always somebody got shot and then we were wondering whether they survived or not. And of course, you have to wait a week, whereas now Netflix, you can tend to binge watch, so you'll of course watch the next episode, whereas now there isn't another episode, and it might be, you know, a month, 2 months, so people are going to be on the edge of their seats, Mark, wondering what this next thing is, because you've built that up beautifully. It is a bit like a JR being shot moment, which anybody sort of under 40 will probably have no idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah, probably so.
Look up JR and Dallas on the internet. How do you see the GP practice and the veterinary practice differing? Because you said there were some similarities, but there's some differences. Maybe give a few examples, apart from that obvious one that you can take people back to the NHS.
Yeah, I think we need to understand it. You probably need to divide it into primary care, i.e. general practice, and secondary care within the hospital system and so forth. I think with secondary care, for a long time, people have been relatively familiar with the idea of there being a private system and an NHS system. And I think broadly speaking, people knew how that worked. We now see a lot of people going through on self-pay. The practice is based in a local private hospital, and there are a lot of people there who are self-paying for operations that would traditionally have long waiting times, hip replacements, knee replacements, the classic things you might imagine. Yeah. And also, people are very familiar with the idea of insurance paying for secondary care. Except for people who are working here from abroad, there really aren't that many people who are insured for primary care for going to the GP. It's just something that hasn't really existed. So private practice has served a very small number of people who are insured, and a very thin layer of people at the top of the social economic strata, at least, who will be able to afford it or want the privacy that's involved and so forth. So the primary side is very different, and it's very fragmented. And in many ways, if you talk to people who were involved in veterinary economics 20 years ago, a lot of the things that are happening on the human side, you would argue, are very similar to that. You've got GPs setting up on their own. You've got all the big insurance companies that try to set up general practices, but because they work differently, they don't necessarily have things that are that successful. And it is a very different business. And as we said earlier, one of the big differences between the veterinary situation and the human primary care is the fact that you have always got the option. You have got the NHS option to take people back to. But that's becoming increasingly difficult, because that is difficult to access in certain areas. And also now, because of the huge workload, both intellectually, which is getting worse for GPs particularly, and also the sheer number of patients, it's actually getting harder for people to go and actually see their GP. And as much as some of the allied professionals are doing a really good job, there is still the issue of the patient-doctor relationship. And I think just as people appreciate seeing the same vet with their pet or the same vet on farm, people really appreciate that continuity. It's not just about what you say and how you say it. Also, who you are makes a difference as to whether somebody will actually take your advice or be satisfied or whatever. And I think increasingly there's a recognition in human healthcare that the outcome is not about necessarily just curing, it's about actual patient satisfaction. And in many cases, that's equally as important. And you only have to look at things like palliative care and the arguments over euthanasia to realize why that is very different. So there are some areas that are completely different. And then there are some areas that are the same. And the one that I would like to highlight, which I think is so topical at the moment, is what happens if you go see a private GP and then you have to have some tests done. And just to give you a little bit of an idea, one of the local private practices here, it's not expensive, but their charge for a hematology sample will be just about £112. And I don't think there are many veterinary practices that are going to be charging that for a full blood count. And I think this illustrates perfectly the problem for the veterinary profession, because most people go to the doctor, get their blood sample, and never see the bill. They have no idea what the cost of those things would be involved. And that is quite fascinating. And actually what people will do in that situation is they will go, okay, well, what I'll do is I'll go and ask my GP to do those tests instead, and I'll get them for free. Then I'll come back and I'll pay the private GP. So for an opinion on it. So there are some big differences, and it's much more fragmented, much, much, much more in the sense you haven't got the dominant players and so forth. And it's hard to predict where we will go with that. I think a lot of it will depend on politics and will depend on what the politicians decide that they want to do next.
Well, I think we've seen it even more so with the dentists, where, you know, you literally cannot get hold of a GP, an NHS dentist. So therefore you've had, you know, people have had to go private. Yeah. And if they haven't got the money, then teeth fall out, or you know, that. So it's a bad situation.
Absolutely. And I think that illustrates again the differences. I mean, I think it's quite interesting to actually compare private dentists with doctor with GPs with vets, because from the dentist's point of view, the big advantage they had over the GPs was GPs were obliged to continue to provide a service, so their ability to actually be militant was much less so than the dentists. Ultimately, there was another way someone could get dental care, and I think the British Dental Association did a good job with the politicians and with their negotiations. And it's going to be very hard for the government to go back to, you know, where they would like to go with that. Whereas I think GPs have not taken the opportunity. They're naturally not a very militant group, and they find it very, very hard to find ways of making their case without impacting very badly on the care of their patients. And they are, again, you know, they're a group with a lot of stress, a lot of mental health issues for the same reasons as we talk about with the vets.
I suppose there's that moral injury that we've talked about, you know, on this podcast channel. If people feel that they can't do things or they're doing things that they disagree with, then it is very damaging for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, that is clearly an issue with GPs. But as I say, I think it's a much bigger issue in the veterinary side. I think the counterbalance to that is whether we like it or not, I think most people would argue that a human life is more important than an animal's life. So you've got that balancing on one side versus the fact that on the veterinary side, you're going to be making many more decisions based on quality of life, potentially euthanasia, so forth. So the stresses are different, but they're there, aren't they, in both professions.
Yeah.
The way that it's happened in human GPs is quite interesting. We know that the average working life of a qualified graduate now is very short on the vet side. What's happened on the human side is slightly different. And what's happened there is there are less and less people who are able to cope with working full time. So when you look at the total number of GPs in the country, actually the government could make you quite a reasonable statistic. But if you look at full time equivalents, it's actually quite a different story. And that's related to the pressure of the work and the number of hours that they work. So there are very few people who will now work what would consider traditionally to be full time in general practice. Yeah, they couldn't do that. It's impossible.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. And I must admit, Mark, I'm very pleased that you're coming back into the veterinary profession, because we've missed you for that year or two that you've been out doing GP stuff. But I'm sure that's been a huge benefit for them. But I'm being greedy, and we're getting you back. And as I say, we are on a bit of a cliffhanger. So don't leave us hanging too long before we have our next chat, if you don't mind.
Oh, absolutely not. No problem at all. And I'll bring you in some graphs of solar charts and battery storage, and we can really make a podcast that only you and I would want to watch.
Well, I think only, and now I'm going to be accused of sexism, but I'm basing it on a reasonable number of people. It does tend to be men who sort of, follow the charts and try to make sense of them and then talk about them in the pub. Whereas I think women see the benefit of solar, but aren't so shallow that they have to spend hours just talking about batteries and things.
Yeah, you could be right. I think you've probably got to contrast my view of electric motoring with my wife's to get a good example of that. It's a very, very different experience hearing her talk about the same vehicle as I do. So, I think you're probably on fairly safe ground there. You'd probably be okay with that comment.
Well, thank you, Mark. I'm not sure that you're the person who can absolutely tell me that, because we're probably a bit too similar. But we'll see if we get anybody shouting at me.
Indeed. We will wait and find out.
Yeah, really good to see you and to chat. And I think about, joking aside, some really important issues. One of my themes for this year is to get 300 practices to put solar panels on their roof, because that would have a massive effect. You know, we want to reduce carbon by about 50% in the veterinary industry within the next 7 to 10 years. How are we going to do that? The longer we leave it, the more difficult it will be. So getting practices to start embracing that, to put solar on the roof, I think can be a, you know, a massive step forward. So hopefully if anybody's listening and has got the bug from listening to us, it's not only now an environmental and a moral imperative, but actually it makes financial sense to do it. If you've got a little bit of money behind you, go and get some solar panels. And it is nice when you're not having to pay the greedy energy companies money for free electricity from the sun. So thanks again, Mark. Appreciate your time. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And hopefully see you on another podcast or a webinar very soon. Take care and bye-bye.